This group of poems has a bit of a darker cast to it. The title of the first one is called The Other Side of the Light. My mother-in-law's former lover killed himself last Thursday. She just found out over the phone. She and my wife talk about him in hushed tones in the living room. I stare out the study window at an acre of new snow, a foot deep, maybe more. The trees, apple, locust, maple, oak, hover above it, like dark shrouds, disconnected from the ground. Death is, I'm sure, self-evident in an exhaust-filled garage. It is not a few bare trees in the backyard. It is probably not even very frightening. Someone looks at the bloated blue face and says, for the record, dead. I wonder how long it is after the last breath before time evaporates. The past, the future, all of it, just a ball of smoke caught in the throat. One small cough, and it mingles with infinity. Alan Johnson wanted to be rich. He failed. Chunks of his money sunk into one bad investment after another. His own doing, really, an undoing. Guesses, bad news, broke. No, not even anywhere near broke, just not as rich as he needed to be by, say, last Thursday, when he must have sat down and said, for the record, dead. His past, his future, didn't reconcile, even if the instant they surrounded could not, because of them, be different by one iota from what it was. None of us ever lives in the moment, except maybe at the passing of that last breath, past and future colliding finally at the only point they will ever have in common. My wife and mother-in-law are not talking any longer. Perhaps they have gone off for a walk. I try to get back to what I wanted to write about, the other side of the light, right before light starts. None of this seems quite right. That white-haired man slumped over the steering wheel of a Jeep Eagle in a garage in New Jersey has nothing, for example, to do with my daughter, who is out in the backyard stomping out the definition of alive in quick, bold strokes across the snow. Now she is laughing and making a racket at the back door. My son is running out to meet her. This is what I would have been writing about. If only I had not looked out the window. If only no one had answered the phone. If only it had not snowed. This is called gentrification. You cursed me, Mrs. Carlonis, just for parking there, or for dropping that bucket-sized block of ice you kept shaking your finger at on the sidewalk in front of your house. I couldn't tell which, only that you were yelling and crying at the same time. At me, that life was too hard, the snow too heavy to move. I just took the shovel from your hands and started shoveling. When I was done, I told you to come up the street and get me whenever the snow got too deep to sweep away with a broom. Then I picked up that odd block of ice. Maybe you thought I had carted it in and dumped it there as a first installment, that all the ice in the neighborhood might soon be piling up around your run-down, heatless house, around your cats, around you. And I carried it up the street. When you died that spring, without even once having come to get me, I could still see in my mind's eye your sad, teary, astonished face watching me walk away. Maybe you were grateful I had shoveled your walk. And I think you wanted to believe I had nothing to do with the ice, your grief, those fears, but I really don't know. I read in the papers later that you owned the vacant, dilapidated houses on either side of the one you seemed to live in. The contractors came and went. Realtors with names like Brianna and Leota put up signs. $199,000, $219,000, $249,000. They all sold fast. I wondered all the time I lived up the street if you had enough to eat. And I still wonder how that block of ice got there, why you thought it was mine, why I live now with the fear that your raging at me never really ceased, why it seems to me sometimes that the whole neighborhood is filling up with ice and tears, and I can't any longer be sure which of the two I am leaving behind me on the street and which I must carry with me when I leave. These poems are called Postcards from the Shore. Monday. A dank wind clambers in off the fog-blank Atlantic. My daughter and I pick through little heaps of shells, the litter of last night's storm still stalled offshore. "Show me how brave you are," she taunts, daring me to chase the receding surf, then outrace it as it rushes up the beach. I play that game over and over, if only to avoid explaining to her that what little I know about bravery lately is how much it can take just to turn around. Tuesday. The sea is gun barrel blue and roiling. Wind pushes back breath, deafens. My wife and I stride diligently into it. I try to think of what I used to say to her on walks like these. Dark swirls of seaweed keep churning up between the words I need to speak. Wednesday. Wind and water wake me wide at one. I roll over, whispering, "Oh, shit," expecting it to make a difference. Wave after wave crashes rhythmically in the background. I repeat whatever I can think of to recover sleep. Little Bo Peep has lost her sheep and can't know where to find them. I know just how she must have felt. You wake up one night in a start from what you thought was only a bad dream, and there, the whole field in front of you is empty. Thursday. It is nearly midnight. The skies have finally cleared. Each incoming wave as it curls to break is momentarily molten with moonlight, which scatters then in thousands of sparks among the wet shell shards along the shore. I wade out waist deep into the cold combers, wanting to believe that the sea, which cleanses everything, can cleanse me. Friday. Six or seven seagulls fly single file in close formation inches over the ocean, each one silhouetted for an instant against the huge red sun hovering just above the horizon. I see it this morning as a hole poked through the ceiling of a large gray room where I have been forced to stay for days and days, opening now into a place alive with light that pleases even the seagulls, which celebrate by squawking just as we drive off.